It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. President Trump is expected to survey hurricane damage in Puerto Rico today.
We lose everything. First floor and second floor, everything is gone. Everything is gone.
That's Edith Negron of the Puerto Rican town of Florida. Just ahead, we get a view of the relief effort through the eyes of Puerto Ricans living in Georgia. But first, this week began with a mass murder in Las Vegas. With dozens killed and hundreds injured, the scale of the massacre is unprecedented in modern U.S. history. But this type of story is becoming sadly familiar.
When I came into work, my head writer was standing in my office with a sheaf of papers. And he said, "Here are the remarks you made after the Sandy Hook shootings and the Pulse nightclub attacks in Orlando. You might want to look at them to see what you might want to say tonight." How could there be a file of mass shooting remarks for a late night host? When did that become normal?
That's Conan O'Brien on his show last night. We always want to know what you think. How are you processing the events in Las Vegas? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. It's 2 weeks ago now that Hurricane Maria slammed the entire U.S. territory of Puerto Rico. Maria came hard on the havoc of other recent storms, leaving the entire island of Puerto Rico damaged, flooded, without basic necessities, with disrupted supply lines and no electricity. Nearly 90,000 Puerto Ricans live in Georgia, about a fourth of them living in Cobb and Gwinnett counties. Cynthia Roman Hernandez is a managing director of Atlanta's Latin American Association, and she is a Puerto Rican Georgian. And so is Juan Carlos Rodriguez, a professor at Georgia Tech. I should say that they are married, too. Welcome, folks.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So we're hearing so little and some of it conflicting about what's happening. What's the state of relief efforts in Puerto Rico? What are you hearing from your own families?
So my family at this point is okay. The ones that are in San Juan, they are seeing more gas stations opening and supermarkets. But still, my family from Morovis, which is my hometown, they'll still block from many support. Some of them have to drive 3 or 4 hours to get gas or food, and some of them are just not being able to find anything. So they're just struggling. They're just exhausted and overwhelmed about all this situation.
Yeah, Juan, what are you hearing?
Yeah, basically the same. The situation in San Juan, it is very tough, but apparently there are more resources, stores that are recovering from the disaster, gas stations. It is still a day-to-day struggle, but there is more access in the metropolitan area. Once we move into the mountains, the situation is very difficult. We have heard of reports of people that are having just one meal per day, and this is an organized effort by neighbors of different neighborhoods, no, in the mountain, because they would like to save the food resources that they have. So yeah. the aid is not reaching everyone in Puerto Rico right now.
So that's the immediate risk to people's health and lives. It is lack of access to food and potentially water as well.
There is also another aspect, which is medical services. On top of the lack of water, lack of food, and also the possibility of epidemic outbreaks, there's also concern with many patients that haven't been able to receive dialysis or medication for their conditions, or even they haven't had access to an oxygen tank, and so many people have died of this lack of medical attention. No?
All right. Here's Elaine Duke, acting Secretary of Homeland Security for President Trump, and here she is talking about the administration's response to Maria in Puerto Rico.
I know it's a hard storm to recover from, but the amount of progress that's been made, and I really would appreciate any support that we get. I know it is really a good news story.
And then here's the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Cruz, responding to those comments on CNN.
This is not a good news story. This is a people are dying story. This is a life or death story. There's a truckload of stuff that cannot be taken to people's story. This is a story of a devastation that continues to worsen.
And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Juan Carlos Rodriguez, a Puerto Rican Georgian and assistant professor of Spanish at Georgia Tech. Also with us is Cynthia Roman Hernandez of Atlanta's Latin American Association. They're a married couple from Puerto Rico living in Georgia. About 90,000 Puerto Ricans live in Georgia. And we're talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. And folks, those comments from Mayor Cruz of San Juan got her a little bit of blowback. Some people were saying, look, the death toll isn't very substantial at this point. Relief is coming. Did you really need to be so extreme in your comments? But I suppose you could argue that rhetoric like that is related to the fact that relief efforts have improved in recent days. Is that your sense?
As I said, there are some parts of the island, like San Juan, that they are seeing more improvement in the conditions of the situation, and there's very pockets of the San Juan area, not all of them, but the remote area of the island, they are just not receiving the services or the support that they need. And one of the worries that we had is that, the medical access, but also there are some people that have no income at this point. They have not working for 2 weeks, and they have been using what they had. And they're just helping each other, but still they're a lot of business that they are not being able to open in, so there's a lot of unemployment, people not able to work. So that's one of the concerns also in the community, that there the impoverishment of the population.
Certainly. Those comments from Mayor Cruz of San Juan seem to elicit some tweets from President Trump. Over the weekend, the president tweeted, quote, "Such poor leadership ability by the mayor of San Juan and others in Puerto Rico who are not able to get their workers to help," end quote. And then here's another one from the president, another tweet. He tweeted, "They want everything to be done for them when it should be a community effort. 10,000 federal workers now on the island doing a fantastic job," end quote. How did you guys react to that?
I think that those are very unfortunate comments coming from the president of the United States. I think they reveal the degree of the ingrained ideology of colonialism in play and a completely invisible ideology. How can you talk about Puerto Ricans in that way when they have been subject to colonialism for more than 100 years? They are currently trying to survive in a situation that is very overwhelming, and they are basically more efficient than federal authorities. And here we have a president that it's simply trying to save his show. I think that's very unfortunate and shameful.
So the Puerto Rican diaspora of folks living in the mainland United States is about 5 million, I believe, at this point, heavily concentrated in the American South, where we are for obvious reasons, and then also in some urban areas further north. I wonder if you folks are... predict more people leaving the island of Puerto Rico for the mainland in response to everything that's happened?
Yes, definitely. That's what we are seeing, more and more people just leaving the island, desperate because of the lack of work, because of the lack of resources, because they are waiting for support and they are not receiving it. And They are just there. Some of the people that are living in the continental U.S. also, they are bringing their families to U.S. to so they can take care of their health and some other areas of need. But still, there's a lot of people, young people, that they don't feel that you know, the situation will take them to another next step. So they are just leaving, and that's one of our concerns as Puerto Rican, because they, you know, we need to stay strong. We need to continue, you know, working together to reconstruct our island, and that's part of, I think, that the everybody agree, or many of the people that we know agree, that we need to continue helping each other and do what we can do to keep the island, you know, fine and better and stay safe.
Juan, do you ever think about going back, despite the life that you've built yourself for yourself in Atlanta?
Well, I think it's a very difficult situation, and I would like to put in context the natural disaster. This is not, we're not simply dealing with a natural disaster.
Sure.
We're also dealing with a financial disaster, and that has to do with the fact that Puerto Rico recently, months before the hurricane, went bankrupt. The Puerto Rican government have been accumulating a public debt, and it's a very challenging situation for the country. So I think that we would like to see how we're going to deal with that issue as well. One thing I think it's clear, no country can reconstruct itself on the basis of a massive debt.
Yeah.
So we would have to see policy coming to not only deal with the question of our infrastructure, the collapse of all the technological systems and communications, but also a plan for economic development that would guarantee a sustainable future for Puerto Rico.
In our last minute, do you think that a better future for Puerto Rico can be had in the wake of all of this natural and and man-made devastation, given Puerto Rico's current political status as a territory, not as a state, and not having representation in Congress as a result?
I think it's very, very important that we rethink the question of the status at this moment. It hasn't been a priority in Puerto Rican politics over the past 20 years, even though there have been efforts to manage the question of status and consult the people of Puerto Rico. We haven't seen the political will coming from the Puerto Rican parties to address the question. We haven't seen the political will coming from Congress either. So yeah. I think that either statehood or independence, these are the status that I think will guarantee some kind of overcoming of the colonial situation and a path forward in the economic development of the island.
That's Juan Carlos Rodriguez, professor at Georgia Tech. Also, his wife, Cynthia Roman Hernandez, with Atlanta's Latin American Association. Thank you very much. It's on Second Thought.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Headlee. The death toll in Las Vegas now stands at 59. More than 500 more people were injured in the shooting and the stampede that followed. But amid the carnage, there are stories of heroism. Gail Davis attended the music festival where a gunman shot people from the 32nd floor of a nearby hotel. She told CBS News one police officer led her to safety under a tent.
The officer actually covered me up to protect me from being shot because I couldn't get out all the way. And it was like you could hear the shots just like going back and forth and ricocheting. And then they would stop. He said, we need to get out of here. We got to get you out of here. So we went to another little tent. And again, that officer was with me. He was like my guardian angel. He never left me.
To understand what it means to be a hero, consider Georgia native Shannon Johnson, a graduate of Macon's Windsor Academy. He died in 2015, shielding a coworker in the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. The two attackers were killed after they gunned down 14 people, including Johnson. His then-fiancée, Mandy Pfeiffer, spoke to NPR last December.
He just did what came natural to him and covered the person closest to him and shielded her from a lot of bullets. You know, when they got down, in his low southern drawl, he just said, you know, I got you. It was just natural.
But friends and family say Johnson's heroics were also in his DNA. His father died years earlier trying to save a coworker during a factory accident. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with Rob Johnson, Shannon Johnson's brother.
How old were you when your father passed away?
10.
And tell me the story of how he died.
It was a work-related accident in nuts and bolts of it. A safety inspector was on the premises, and they got word that he was in trouble. He was down in one of those industrial tanks that are about 12 feet down. You have to take the ladder down. He got overcome by some poisonous gas fumes. My dad took it upon himself to go down there and try to rescue the guy. There was no safety equipment on the premises, and as everybody's looking on, my dad, he's about 150 pounds, 5'8". The guy's trying to fireman's carry up the ladder is about 200, they said 210, something like that, and it just was too much for him. They said he sat the body down, came back up, went back down, and just got overcome by the fumes himself and drowned in the bottom of the tank in a little bit of water.
And that was not the first time. I mean, we don't have to go into every incident, although they're all really interesting stories, but your father had a history of putting himself on the line, even in the military, to save other people that he didn't know.
Yeah, some type of post or something in some type of military exercise, it fell, and he pushed the gentleman out of the way, the other soldier out of the way, and it hit him full in the back, and that's how he got discharged from the Army.
So I wonder what your thoughts were when you heard about Shannon's death. Were you surprised that he'd given his life?
Well, after the initial shock, I lost my right arm, but after I got over the initial shock, my wife and I were laying in bed and just kind of praying together, and we both just looked at each other and said, you know he saved somebody. You know he probably went after the shooter. That's just the way Shannon is. He's fiercely protective, and that's just the way Shannon was.
Before you even knew what had happened to Shannon, you assumed he'd done something heroic, and that's how he died.
Yes. Yeah, that's just the way Shannon is. Our prayers were answered the next day. Denise's sister posted on Facebook, and the rest, you know, it's all well documented about what happened there.
So help me kind of grapple with this question that we have today, which is, what makes someone choose to do that? We spend so much time trying to figure out the minds of sociopaths or murderers or people who commit horrific acts. But I want to understand the mind of someone like your father or Shannon. What makes someone make that choice?
I think that's just what they do. It's what they know. That they just try to be the best person they can be and take care of others at all costs. I mean, I think that's just the way they were built. I think it comes from my paternal grandparents. I think they instilled a lot of those values in both of them. And Shannon really looked up to our dad. That was our hero. And Shannon was my personal protector. No one could get near me, Celeste. And everywhere we went, I felt totally protected because Shannon had me. But that's gone. But I still have them. I mean, they're still my personal protectors. They're just in another spot now. They're up in heaven. But on their gravestones, we have John 15:13, greater love hath no one than this, that he laid down his life for his friends. And that's on both my dad and my brother's gravestones. I think that's what it is in a nutshell. We just need to learn to love each other more, you know? I mean, it's crazy what's going on out there. But I, as protectors and my loved ones, I'm just so proud of them. You know, I could talk about them all day. There's just so many stories. Near and dear to my heart now is my wife is a breast cancer survivor, and she's my current hero, and just how strong she is each and every day, how she's preparing for this. We're just trying to get her ready for this, and I just wish everyone listening would just send out their prayers to my wife, Beth.
how do you then understand the actions that others take? Does it give you, I guess, a better understanding of why they chose to do that?
No, not really. I mean, Shannon would protect anyone. He'd give the shirt off his back. My dad was, I was told, was the same way. They were very life of the party. Everyone felt they were their best friends. They were always the protectors, always very fierce, always very, they're very tough guys too now. They're very, very tough.
And you had contact with the woman that Shannon saved.
Yeah, Denise, she's really sweet, and she was had gotten married, and she and her husband, they just had a baby, and they named their daughter after Shannon.
And she was afraid. Reportedly, she was afraid to have contact with you and your family because she thought you'd be angry.
Huh. I don't know. I don't remember hearing that she was afraid to contact us. We might be angry. No,
when she came to.
Oh, when she came to the funeral, we embraced her, and we just loved her and embraced her, and we appreciated that she was there.
That's Rob Johnson of Gray, Georgia. He's the brother of Shannon Johnson, one of the victims of the San Bernardino shooting in 2015. Rob spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley. Whether it's San Bernardino or Las Vegas, we find heroes emerge during times of tragedy, and heroes are born or made, nature or nurture. Zeno Franco studies the psychology of heroics. He's an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Celeste spoke to him earlier this year. Franco began discussing whether we are designed to be heroes.
One of the things when we first started looking at this from a kind of a research lens, what makes people act heroically, we heard time and time again people just say, well, I did something heroic because I needed to, I had to. It was the thing that I needed to do to fulfill my role, and we just kind of felt like, well, they're kind of being overly humble in some way. As we've thought more and more about it, I think one of the things we've recognized is that oftentimes heroes are really just in that moment taking the next right action, and they're not thinking about, am I going to be a hero? Am I doing something that's going to be recognized by my community as something, you know, super important? They just do the next right thing, and so that's one of the things that I certainly hear there.
So let me play you a couple clips, because we actually went out and talked to people in Atlanta about what being a hero means. The first one, he's talking more about an everyday hero.
My name is Terrell Bembury. I live in East Atlanta. Have I done anything heroic? Done a lot of things heroic. Taking care of my son on my own. Can't give up. That's your bloodline. I mean, you know what I mean? If he eat before I eat, then I had a happy day, then that makes me a hero that day, you know what I mean? Because as long as he eat, then I'm good.
That's one definition, and here's another one.
Mary Ann McFarland. I live in Conyers, Georgia, and I'm retired, a retired school teacher. A hero would be somebody that does something extraordinary that most people would not do to help other people.
And that's different than your sort of everyday hero, right? One is an extraordinary act that, say, 90% of the population would not do. One is being strong and resilient in the face of sort of life's challenges. So which definition do you use for research?
So I think we're looking at all aspects of it. I think one of the things that happened initially in this work is sort of thinking about heroes as what we call a heroic elect, that there can only be a very few number of people that sort of meet this high bar for taking risks and responding effectively in a crisis situation. The reality is that probably everyone can act heroically, maybe not every single person, but almost every person can do something that is heroic in some degree in their life. And we actually have some research evidence for that too. So there was a large national random sample study that was done by one of my mentors, Dr. Phil Zimbardo, and a team that he works with in California. And they found that actually 20 to 25% of random sample taken, people say, you know, yes, I have done something heroic in my past. And what's interesting about that too is that it often we found that minorities were folks that were reporting that they had to act heroically more often, maybe because they were in some complex situations in an urban environment or whatever. So, you know, we think that more people than not encounter situations where they can act heroically. Some people maybe are afraid to, but it's really something that's available to all of us.
But what about that moment? How many people, when they make that decision, know that their life might be on the line? And I ask that because I bet the situation in which intervening to stop someone from harassing a couple young women in most cases would not end up costing someone their life, right? I mean, you don't know that when you intervene.
You don't all the way. You may not know what the outcome is, but I think a lot of, I mean, when you're encountering somebody, you know, with a weapon and you decide to step forward, there's a lot on the line. And I think one of the things that I talk about is the heroic stance, right? You may or may not be a hero in the end, but you're approaching the situation from the perspective of, I'm willing to engage with this risk. And this is where sort of the more serious heroics comes in, right? Not what you're talking about as everyday heroism, but sort of this risk-based heroism. And it is a big choice. And one of the things that we've also found, there's a graduate student at Claremont Graduate University, Brian Riches, who talks about some research that he's done looking at prudence in heroes. And so one of the things that we've been finding from his work is that many heroes that do take physical risk are probably evaluating that risk rapidly. They're making a very quick decision to engage, but they do think that they can surmount the risk. At the same time, though, they are willing to accept the consequences. And I think that that transcendence of one's own life to put your life on the line is a huge statement about what kind of potential humans have to care for one another.
So then we come to the essential question, which is there a psychological profile of a hero, and can it be developed?
Sure. We don't know if there's a psychological profile yet. I think that's one of the questions that has been being started to be asked over the last decade or so as the sort of science around heroics has kind of gotten into fuller gear. We spent the last century really talking about the social psychology of evil without really thinking about sort of the flip side of the coin, and that's where we are now. So there's about a decade of research on this at this point in time. I think some of the pieces are, you know, what came up with what Rob talking about his brother Shannon, you know, the sort of grit, toughness, physical robustness. Some other pieces that may be genetically predetermined to a little, you know, to some degree, 20 or 30% perhaps, maybe things like risk-taking proclivity, right? So some people are less inclined to take a risk than others. But I think if a person is forced to really encounter a situation that is dangerous, at some point in time, even people that don't want to engage with risk will have to step up to the plate and often do. So is there a particular profile? No. We do think there are some predispositions for risk-taking, for sort of this robustness. Also probably some people are just more aware of situations, right? So if you're sitting there on your cell phone and you're not looking at the entire situation, you don't see a crisis unfolding, you're not able to respond effectively. Other people are kind of taking in the whole situation. That's something we call situational awareness.
But then in terms of heroism and in terms of developing or sponsoring it, what we just heard was a man talking about an entire family where that kind of sacrifice was encouraged and modeled. And that brings us back to the nature or nurture, which it sounds like we don't have an answer to which is more powerful, right?
In all of these things, I think it's always both, right? So if you look at some of the research on the genetics of risk-taking behavior, probably 20 to 30% of that is genetically controlled. There's a big study in Nature Neuroscience in 2005. I believe the author was Mary Jean Creek, very famous researcher, and she found that about 20 to 30% of risk-taking behavior is probably genetically controlled. The other part is probably nurture, right? It's probably exactly those sort of familial things that Rob was talking about with his father and probably his grandparents passing down a set of ideals. And this is, for me, perhaps the most compelling piece, is it is what we teach, right? In combination with a child's sort of natural born qualities, that is going to impart the sort of heroic perspective. And I think without that training, without imparting that ideal, it's difficult to have people kind of step over into that space.
So in the minute that we have left, Zeno, are there more heroes among humankind than villains?
It's always a struggle, right? It's always a struggle. And I think we are at a turning point in society. We've been dealing with the scourge of terrorism for the last decade. And we really have to think in our local communities, in our churches, in our mosques, in every part of our society. Do we want villainy to win, or do we want to impart these ideals of heroic action and response to crises that effectively bring out the best in humanity? And I think that that is our goal over the next few years. That's what we as individuals must do.
That's Zeno Franco. He's an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He spoke to my colleague Celeste Headley. Just ahead, manage your money one penny at a time. This is On Second Thought. On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Tomorrow, we look into the science behind falling asleep, and we want to include you in that conversation. What are some of the things that keep you up at night? Give us a call, leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Money certainly keeps a lot of people up at night, or perhaps more accurately, a lack thereof. The less money you have, the more you think about money, and the more carefully you spend it. That's one finding in Rachel Schneider's new book, The Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. The book follows the lives of lower and middle income households as they try to manage their money. And she is speaking at Savannah's Armstrong Center next Thursday, October 12th. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. And also joining us is Atlanta financial advisor Cecily Welch. Hi, Cecily.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. So, Rachel Schneider, tell us about the rather ambitious research project that went into this book.
Sure. And it is ambitious. So what we did is we had 10 field researchers scattered across the country in four different locations, and each field researcher worked with 20 to 30 families. And they met with those families every few weeks and gathered details about every single dollar that came in and out of the family's homes. So it was a remarkable investment by the families themselves to share so much of their time and so much of their information.
And what are your top line findings?
So the biggest thing that we see is really how volatile people's finances are from week to week, right? So what's different about our data set, and there's a ton of financial data collected in the U.S., but what's unusual about what we were able to do is seeing how money moves through a family's life over time, right? Because we had information over a full year. And what we saw was incredible ups and downs, big, big swings. Even for people who work full time, they nonetheless don't have real certainty about how much money they're going to make from paycheck to paycheck. And then, of course, spending is spiky too. So people spend a lot of time and energy kind of trying to manage those ups and downs in income relative to their ups and downs in spending, which, of course, don't necessarily align really neatly.
And what's the rough income bracket that you're looking at in this data set?
So we were, it was all, you could think of it as a lower middle income. So people from about a quarter of the sample was near the poverty line, about a quarter was middle class, the rest were in between. But everybody in our sample had somebody in the family who was working. So this wasn't a story of, what it's like to sort of, inch by off, off of public assistance. This was a story of people who have work. And for the most case, because that work was either hourly or relied on tips and commissions, that work didn't deliver steadiness.
Cecily Welch, as a financial advisor in Atlanta, are the findings of Rachel Schneider's research surprising to you, or is this consistent with what you see?
It's not surprising at all. I'm excited about this book. I'm excited that there is data out there about these individuals. I'm hoping that it will help. These individual conversations will help start a discussion about the systemic and societal issues. Everyone likes to think that, these individuals aren't doing something right. I'm often in meetings in the various committees I'm with, and I'm just shocked at some of the myths that are still out there about people. Well, they don't really know how to budget. It's insulting to tell a working poor person how to budget. They budget well better than anyone I've seen, any of my paying clients. I assure you, they know where every dollar is going because they have to.
Sure. Well, if I look at my own household expenses, you know, my wife and I have been doing better in recent years and sort of gotten to the point where we don't have to think about money that much. We just sort of live a reasonably modest lifestyle and can just sort of be confident that there's going to be enough money in the account to cover the debits that we do. And to me, I sort of felt like making money, the kind of the point of it was that I wouldn't have to think about money. I don't want to worry about it. But the other night, she sort of says to me, you know, maybe we should like go back to budgeting every dollar because I feel like we fritter away a whole lot. Cecily, do you think that's good advice?
I do. I think it's prudent for people to know where their money is going and to spend it with intent. What I mean by that is there's nothing wrong with spending money. I have an issue with wasting money. Yeah. So I think it's valuable to know, hey, we are a foodie family. That's what we're going to spend our money on. Then that means we don't do quite as much in vacations. We don't do the fancy cars. Or it's the other way around. We are going to make sure we travel. Then if we're traveling, we don't do some of the other. So just being prudent and choosing where your money goes, I think, is something that everyone who has the ability should do, even if it's not tracking dollar for dollar. I do think that there is something that you want to do of the comfort level of we now don't have to track every dollar, which is nice. That adds a different stress level. But we know where our money is going and with intent. And as Rachel points out in the book, there's a substantial portion of the population that does not have that luxury.
Certainly. Rachel, in your book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in the World of Uncertainty, what did you hear from the people that you and your researchers were talking to about the psychological impact, not only of their own financial insecurity, but of simply of the necessity of having to track every penny?
Well, you know, it leads to a sense of insecurity and a sense of instability. So the Pew Charitable Trust asked this really amazing question in a national survey. They asked people, would you prefer to have greater stability or to move up the income ladder? And in a way, it's a false question, right? Because if you move up the income ladder, you'll have more stability. But what's nonetheless really shocking from a lot of people's perspective is the fact that 92% of Americans answered they wanted more stability. And we have this sort of national myth that it's all about mobility. But for a lot of people today, they're not feeling stable enough to think about being mobile. And, you know, so I think particularly about
one. You mean sort of class mobility, moving from working poor to upper middle class, something like that.
Exactly. Or even just, yes, absolutely. But also just moving upward in your own life. So I'm thinking about a woman we got to know who lived in Ohio. And she was working so hard to get an education. So this is a woman with kids at home, working full-time, plus going to school on the side so she could get a better job, right? And so that to me is like, it's mobility, right? She wanted a better, more interesting job. And she said, but when we said, what's your main financial goal? She said, I just want to be able to pay all my bills on time and in full every month, you know, without thinking about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's talk about some practical tips. How can people keep a better tab on the money that's coming in and out, a little bit more of a granular tab on it? What do you think, Cecily?
Well, I think we live in an environment where there is a ton of data. People are able to see, did I bounce a check today? What's my checking account balance? And people view that as I'm doing financial planning. I'm taking care of my finances. And that's not it at all. That's just data. That's not information. I work with a lot of people and help them make that next step of what is this data telling me? What can I do with it? Because it's really not how much money do I have. It's what can I do with the money? And so I meet with people who have all this data, have had it for years. They listen to Dave Ramsey. They listen to Warren Buffett. They watch the news. There's just so much information. They're going through analysis paralysis, so they end up not doing anything. And one of the first things I try and tell people is do something. You don't have to do all the 15 things you think you need to do. Let's pick one or two things and move forward. I'll help you make a plan and we'll take it step by step, but just do something. That's really usually the best first step. is to get started.
You talk about the flood of data that people are getting from their finances. I wonder if the increasing transformation of our society into a cashless society is impacting the way that we spend money and how we track our money. Do you have a sense of that, Rachel?
I do, and I think what Cecily is saying is so true. You know, data is not enough, and it is connected to how we process information. So some of the really effective budgeters that we got to know were doing something to make their spending choices tangible, right? They wanted to be able to touch and feel them. So
yeah.
We met one gentleman who never spent in increments of more than $20. That was just, and he always spent in cash, right? This is somebody who was banked, who had the ability to have a card instead, but it just, he wanted to be able to feel it. He wanted to be able to see how much cash he had in his wallet. We met another woman who kept an incredibly detailed spreadsheet of every single dollar she was going to earn and spend over the year. Not everybody has the interest in that level of detail, right? So I think a lot of what is useful for people is to, you have to have some amount of self-awareness, like what is going to work for me, and pick a strategy that's going to work for, and I agree with Cecily, like pick the one thing you're working on, pick one strategy that will help you achieve that one goal.
Rachel,
last
you
thought
hit
goes
the
to
nail.
You, Cecily. Go ahead.
I was going to say you hit the nail on the head. When I work with people about finances, one of the first things they jump to is, hey, what are my investments doing? Like, stop. Are you maximizing your 401k plan? Are you looking at your beneficiary forms? Let's look at that stuff first. So it's really a matter of picking a strategy, giving it a chance to work, and then reevaluating it. Like Weight Watchers works, Nutrisystem works, but not if you switch from day to day. So try this strategy. If you need to be cash, then let's do cash for 6 months. See if that works. If it doesn't, right, let's find something else.
That's Cecily Welch. She is a financial advisor in Atlanta. We were also speaking with Rachel Schneider, author of the new book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Rachel Schneider will be speaking at Savannah's Armstrong Center on the morning of Thursday, October 12th. Thank you both.
Thank you for
having me,
Adam.
And listeners, let's hear from you on this one. What do you do to track the dollars and cents that come in and out of your life? Here's Atlanta resident Laban King on how he budgets his money.
I treat every dollar like 15 cents. And especially, I used to work in the music industry where I got paid a lot, but a little time. So I make sure to just let a dollar stretch as much as possible.
And here's Jana from Atlanta on her budget strategy.
Yeah, I don't actually rely so much on a formal budget. I just try to pay attention to the necessities first and things that don't seem like necessities last.
So listeners, how closely do you track your money? And if you track it closely, what do you do? Give us a call, leave a message, 404-500-9457, or you can tweet at OST Talk. Find us on Facebook. We're on Second Thought, and we might feature your comments on the show. Our friends at WUGA in Athens have a new radio show focused on finances. It's called Nothing Funny About Money, and they aim to make financial topics more approachable, even entertaining. The show hosts are professors Matt Gorin and Michael Jean Thomas of the College of Family and Consumer Sciences at the University of Georgia. Let's sample a portion of their second episode called Money Can't Buy Happiness, or Can It?
How can we manage our money to make us happier?
You've heard the phrase, the best things in life are free.
Oh, how about can't buy me love?
Can't buy me love. That's a good one. How about money is the root of all evil?
That's dark.
Well, you don't need money to be happy, right?
I don't know.
Well, let's see what the research says about that.
Once people are making about $75,000 a year, additional income ceases to have any real impact on people's day-to-day happiness.
That was Elizabeth Dunn speaking at Pop Tech a few years ago. She's a social psychologist at the University of British Columbia.
Okay, so people make $75,000 a year. They're relatively happy. Their happiness is capped?
Yep. That's what the researchers are saying.
Okay, I'm middle class, 75 grand a year, and a billionaire like Bill Gates, no happier than me.
I wouldn't go that far. But he's buying anything he wants, and he never runs out of money. A new Lamborghini every single day, puts a brick on the gas pedal, drives it off a cliff. He won't run out of money. And that guy's no happier than I am.
All right. I think we're mischaracterizing Bill Gates a little bit here. To your point on happiness, however, you are correct.
Okay.
All right. You actually gave a great example of what the problem is.
I did?
Yeah. Who drives a car off a cliff? Well, I guess there was that one scene in Doctor Strange when he was
where he breaks his hands. Yeah, okay. So that didn't make him very happy.
No, it didn't. Exactly. And neither was Doctor Strange after that incident.
Okay. Here, all right. So what's going on here? Why are you saying that wouldn't make Bill Gates very happy, or Doctor Strange, or whoever?
All right. Okay. So you can't handle the whole Doctor Strange stuff. I get it.
Still
so
no idea what
here's the kicker. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Matt, stop laughing. Get it under control.
I'm ready.
People spend their money on things they think will bring them happiness, but won't.
Oh, that sounds a lot like how lottery winners act.
Indeed. And here's Michael Norton from Harvard Business School to paint us a little bit of a picture.
So what happens when people win the lottery is, number one, they spend all the money and go into debt. And number two, all of their friends and everyone they've ever met find them and bug them for money. And it ruins their social relationships, in fact. So they have more debt and worse friendships than they had before they won.
Okay, so people are spending their money on things like Lamborghinis are going to destroy. And their relationships start to suffer.
Right. And about half of lottery winners end up bankrupt within, guess, how many years would you think they end up bankrupt?
Never. Zero. Infinity years.
Infinity years. I would hope so, because that's still my hopes and aspirations. Right? I would really not bankrupt, but to win the lottery. I'd love to win the lottery and for that money to last for an infinite amount of years. But the reality is that most lottery winners end up bankrupt within 5 years.
Oh, my God. All right. So they're bankrupt. They feel guilty. Their friends are asking them for money.
Yep.
They're pushing these people out of their lives. That does sound like that's not good. That could help explain why these people making all this money, they're not doing any better.
Those were the voices of UGA professors Matt Gorin and Michael Gene Thomas, hosts of WUGA's new show, Nothing Funny About Money. It airs locally in Athens on the first Friday of every month at 1:30 p.m. And that's it for our show today, but let's hear from you. How do you keep track of your finances? What do you wish you knew how to do with regard to your money? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also post to Facebook or Twitter. We're at OST Talk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Have a good one.